Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C, this is Agriculture Today.
The question about fertilizer and being more efficient, that is a very insulting question to the producers. Just like you as a normal taxpayer, a normal consumer, don't buy a bunch of groceries and throw them away because they're cheap. Producers are the most, in this country, are the most efficient in the world, or trying to be the most efficient in the world. They don't waste fertilizer. It costs money. They're already doing as a great job. Now,
Dr. Joe Outlaw is co-director of the Agriculture Food Policy Center.
We saw with the doubling of the fertilizer price that people shifted to soybeans, which you don't have to fertilize as much with nitrogen. But anyway, so back to your question. Sorry with that rant, but I get that question a lot. And frankly, it's insulting to the producers because they're trying their best to be the most efficient they can be.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
You know, we do have some issues that we have to address, but I would say that we need to stop looking at the border as the one-yard line, because we are talking about putting so many resources on the one-yard line called the border.
Discussing appropriations for Homeland Security, Dr. Henry Cuellar represents the 28th District of Texas.
What we ought to do is extend the perimeter and look at what we ought to do on the 20-yard line. We ought to look at more resources outside the border, give Homeland authorities where they can do the work outside the border, and look at how we can work with Mexico, Central America, Panama, Colombia, and other countries to address this issue. Now, this bill has a lot of bipartisan investments and requirements that we need to look at, but there's still some things that we need to look at. I'll start off with the border. I know that for a lot of y'all, the border wall is so important to address, but again, it is a 14th century solution to a 21st century problem. When you look at the people coming in, there are some people that want to come in that try to evade, but the majority of the people that we're seeing right now are going to turn themselves in because they're asking them for asylum. Now, I don't want to get into the debate of asylum because most of those folks don't qualify under the law. The law is you got to have persecution by the state based on religion, sex, or one of those reasons. If it's drought or it's another reason, crime and all that, it doesn't qualify him for asylum. I don't want to get into the debate of asylum right now, but I do want to say that if you think a wall is going to stop him, it's not. It's not going to happen. Let me give you a reason. I know our governor talked about putting some buoys. That was only less than of a quarter of a mile of the buoys for a 1,200-mile border. Quarter of a mile, less than a quarter of a mile for 1,200 miles. You talk about the wall, let's look at where the boundary is on the U.S.-Mexico border. If you look at the 1,200 miles river that we have, the boundary is actually the middle of the river. Do we put a fence there? No, we don't. Do we put it at the riverbanks? No, we don't. Because if you put it at the riverbanks, the water's going to get it washed off. So we usually put the fence about a quarter mile or a half a mile away from the river. So if somebody's asking for asylum, they'll cross the river, they'll touch the riverbanks, they'll walk up a quarter of a mile, they'll walk up to a half a mile and then ask for asylum. So does a fence stop them when we're spending $36 million a mile, where we can use $3 million a mile? No, it doesn't.
Dr. Michael Burgess represents the 26th District of Texas.
I mean, you and I in 2014, all of the unaccompanied minors that were coming to Lackland Air Force Base in San Antonio, and Ana Hernandez, the First Lady of Honduras, came to Texas, and she was asked, "Don't you want your children back?" And she said, "Yes, of course we want our children back." And the Obama administration accommodated and sent a lot of the children back. And the effect that have, if I recall correctly, was to dramatically reduce the influx of unaccompanied children at that time. So we do know that repatriating people or turning people back or remain in Mexico, whatever we want to call it, does work. I think we probably disagree a little bit about the functionality of a border wall. The whole idea is you get people to the port, you push them to the ports of entry rather than just what we've been seeing on our television screens. I mean, it just can't live like that.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
We have about 8 or 9 months of prices now, and I have actually a pretty good idea of what yields are going to be for the summer crops based on some yield projections that I have. And at this time, we also know what the government payments for last year are going to be that they get paid this year. So I have a pretty good feel for what's really going to happen with net farm income at this point in time.
Kansas State Farm Management Specialist Greg Ibendall.
I really concentrate on our KFMA grain farm. So the KFMA, Kansas Farm Management Association data, is really the backbone that goes into this, as well as looking at my projection for prices and yield. But I use the KFMA data to get a lot of the expenses from. So basically, we take that data and we have a pretty good idea of what things are going to be. So we basically plug that into a model and I can look at really what I think is going to happen with net farm income for the coming year. So like I said, we have an idea for prices and yields at this point in time. We use 2022 KFMA farms really to get an idea for the expenses. I kind of update those based on what has happened during the year. So I have an idea what happened last year with fertilizer, obviously, but as the year goes on, I have a new projection with, I can plug in the current fertilizer prices to see how that paid out. I also have to accommodate for the fact that there could be some idea of farmers buying their expenses earlier and then maybe not expensing it till next year. What, you know, farmers doing cash-based accounting, they can really buy stuff earlier and then account it in this year where it may not show up really from an accrual perspective in the next year. So looking at those kind of things, that's how I kind of go about getting all the expenses in and kind of updating my model as I go. I think I was pretty pessimistic back in February. I think I still showed up overall average profit, but it has since really kind of increased quite a bit. So, you know, there's been a few bad things happening during the course of the year. Certainly grain prices have went down over what I first thought they were going to be, but that's really kind of counter offset by the fact that I think crop insurance payments are going to probably be higher than what they would have originally because of those lower grain prices. So I factor that in there. I also factor in what the yields are going to be. So yields are probably going to be a little higher than what we first thought. You know, the wheat yield didn't actually turn out to be quite as bad as what they thought. I think we ended up with about a 32 to 35 yield for the state. Now, again, that's a lot of wheat acres didn't get harvested. So we have a better idea for that. And then I have a final number for the crop insurance numbers too. So there are going to be some payouts if you have the right kind of base anyway out in western Kansas, especially for corn. So that kind of helps out in the revenue side. Really, the revenue side hasn't really declined that much over what I first saw. I think the big benefit actually is expenses have gone down quite a bit over what they were first projected to be. At one point last fall, I think, you know, fertilizer for anhydrous was like $1,500 a ton. You know, really, it's probably less than half that now. Now, the big question is how much of that improvement in fertilizer is actually going to show up this year? I know a lot of farmers probably bought their spring fertilizer back last fall, but there's still going to be some farms, I think, that took advantage of that, especially for the wheat production this fall. I think farmers are going to see some advantage if they apply fertilizer to get that going. So there is going to be some cost reduction this year. Again, some of that may not really show up till next year, but when you take the combination of the fact that we had probably pretty even revenue for this year compared to last year with the fact that expenses are going down, I think we're definitely going to see an improvement in that regard. And even though I don't have very many livestock farms in my mix, you know, I'm basically just looking at the KFMA grain farms. There is some livestock farms that show up in those mix, and really there's a big improvement on the livestock side, so that'll help as well. I think the overall picture is we're probably looking at probably better net farm income this year than we had last year. I think I'm looking at probably about an average of about $150,000 to $70,000 or so, depending if you're talking about the median or the mean value. Again, there's a little difference between how you calculate those. Some of the better farms tend to bring up our average. But really, you know, last year, this 2022 wasn't a total disaster. I mean, it may look that way if you look at it over the last 5 to 7 years, but really from a historical perspective, you go back and look at 20 years, really 2022 net farm income was probably above average. I think this year in 2023 will be above that. So really an improvement for most farms. If I look at the number of farms that actually probably have negative net farm income, which is really what we're kind of looking at the tails of our distribution. Really, in 2022, we probably had about 10% of our farms that had negative net farm income. I really think in 2023, we're probably looking at a very similar case, so not too many farms that are going to be in trouble. Really an overall improvement. Now, the situation certainly gets different when we get to 2024.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
We have a countercyclical safety net that when things go bad, the government steps in pretty significantly. When things are good, the government kind of takes a step back and lets the market function.
Dr. Joe Outlaw is co-director of the Agriculture Food Policy Center at Texas A&M.
So that's a really, really important thing for people to remember is that all this safety net, Title I discussion, we can talk about conservation, we can talk about climate change, all those things within the context of the Farm Bill. But when you look at the safety net side, it's all about the bad times. And frankly, as a couple of people have alluded to, the bad times are coming. They're just not here right now. And so it really makes it, I've been quoted across the press quite a bit recently saying that this is a terrible time to do a farm bill. One, all the things going on in Washington, I don't want to reiterate that. But two, the conditions are good. And if you've done 8 farm bills like I have or been involved in them, you see that they're a little bit easier to get things moving when there's some sort of crisis in Washington. And there's not one right now in terms of the ag producers' perspective of their incomes. There's different elements of that are in better shape. So I'm going to focus a little bit more on the safety net. And specifically, I'm going to be talking about, you know, we talk about Title I of the commodity programs. Title 11 is crop insurance. So those are the two primary legs of the three-legged stool of the safety net, other being the loan program, which basically loan rates right now are so low, they're irrelevant. So there's not much support provided by it. But so the two main titles, obviously right now you have most people would say, if you ask producers, saying that crop insurance has been the biggest part of their safety net, and for very good reasons, and people need to understand why. Most of the crop insurance programs use futures prices to set the base price for insurance, the beginning price, and prices have been high, so they've been protected very, very well on their commodities. Now, on the other side of that, and you don't think about it right now, but when prices decline, as John mentioned, and even Jonathan mentioned earlier, when prices are forecast to decline, producers are going to get a lot less protection from their crop insurance, and the cost of the crop insurance program is going to go down because the liability goes down. And so it gets where right now Title 11 crop insurance is the name of the game, but for basically 90 years plus, we've had commodity program payments. We do in this country, we do have 23 covered commodities. Those covered commodities have been deemed by people, policymakers, as the ones that need the protection in this country. Obviously, crop insurance covers a lot more crops, like Stephen alluded to. When you think about the one of the things that I always want to make sure that people understand is producers are not this; they're not sitting on a pile of cash, and so the safety net needs to be bankable. What does that mean? That means that when they go to get a loan, the lenders are going to ask them, where's the protection? I can't give you a loan if there's basically unlimited loss here, because that's too much risk for the banks and they're not going to do it either. And so when you start talking about bankable protection, it's really an important concept of, is the safety net going to step in if things go bad? To what degree? How is that going to work? How's it going to work for this crop versus the other one you might be choosing to produce? And so that really is a concept that matters quite a bit.
Dr. Joe Outlaw speaking recently at a Farm Foundation event. It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
The question that I am trying to reconcile is, in my mind, is why the House Republican majority decided to spend the summer on bills regarding gas stoves and the lesser prairie chicken and then send everyone home for a 47-day recess.
Colorado Representative Joe Neguse.
Only to come back and 7 days before the government is slated to shut down and troops and Border Patrol agents are slated to not receive paychecks, decide that now they'd like to bring this bill to the floor. That is my point. Your answer in the very beginning was a candid one that, you know, I should talk to who's running the place. And that clearly is the speaker and Republican leadership. So I suppose, you know, I don't know that they testify in front of this committee. So maybe I'll be waiting and the American people will be waiting on an answer.
Representative David Joyce is from Ohio and a member of the House Appropriations Committee.
I do believe that negotiations back and forth with between our members, 435 of us, members of this House, taking place that is moving the ball forward, in other words, addressing these concerns on bills like this to get our spending priorities in order, is something that deserves the time it takes to get that done. If we are approaching, like today, we have some bills are coming up. Next week, we'll have some more bills coming before this committee and hopefully getting to the floor. If there's a short period of time, but we're making our striving to get our work done, I think a CR is in order to get to the next set of bills so we can put together, for once and for all, for the American people, 12 appropriation bills set at a finite number in which we can all administer this government and carry out the duties of this government in a way that functions. We haven't done that in a long time.
One of the sticking points for the House Freedom Caucus is the border. Texas Representative Chip Roy.
And I would hope that my colleagues on the other side of the aisle would agree that it should be a nonpartisan truth that we should hold the executive branch accountable. And I've said this before, and I introduced legislation that took positions when President Trump was in the White House to do that. I would hope that my colleagues on the other side of the aisle would join us now to do that. Because this secretary and this president are blatantly disregarding their duty to figure out this problem. And it is a problem that must be dealt with now. Not walking through a presidential election to set some sort of debate about what may or may not occur in January of 2025, but sitting here today, now. So I applaud that this appropriations bill takes significant steps to, for example, deal with the CBP One app that is being abused to use parole on a categorical basis to take people and process them into the United States, yielding yet another record number that we're dealing with here in August and September, well over 200 and something thousand encounters, as I know my friend from Texas in particular knows these facts, the swelling numbers in Eagle Pass that we're seeing right now, the people in train cars and open containers coming here, the thousands mounting in the Darien Gap, people getting overrun, filling up our hospitals, our schools, law enforcement overrun in Texas. I don't know how much is too much for my colleagues on the other side of the aisle to recognize how important it is to shut down the abuse of the border. And that is just a simple reality. And we're talking about shutting down the government. Well, to avoid shutting down the government, why don't we do our job to shut down a wide-open border and force it into actually compliance with the law?
Fellow Texas Representative Henry Cuellar.
We're all on the same page. We want to secure the border. Nobody wants open borders. I certainly don't want open borders. We just got to figure out how we get there. But it takes a little input from all of us. I mean, I know we got a lot of smart folks on the Republican side, but there's some of us on the D side that we can contribute in getting there. And that's what we're asking. And we're just asking, how do we get there?
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
The other taxes that we need to worry about with respect to a succession plan are transfer taxes on the federal level.
Brandon Dirkschneider is president, Insurance Design Management in Omaha at a recent Nebraska Center for Ag Profitability webinar.
And our transfer taxes include a federal gift tax. And a federal gift tax is imposed on a transfer of assets you make during your lifetime. Now, federal estate tax is imposed on transfer of assets that you make upon your death. And then we also have a federal generation skipping transfer tax, which is a tax imposed on transfer of assets to individuals who are more than one generation below you. For example, your grandchildren. That's subject to both life and death. Now, these gift tax, estate tax, or GST tax all fall underneath one exemption. And we'll talk about that exemption more and how that's applicable. But this tax rate, once you get over the exemption amount, it starts at 40%. So it's a significant tax that some of our family farm and ranch operators are going to see. The other aspect is Nebraska has an inheritance tax that was just modified here on January 1st, 2023. So immediate relatives, your children, are subject to a 1% inheritance tax on anything worth more than $100,000. Nieces and nephews on assets that you leave them in excess of $40,000 have an inheritance tax of 11%. And if you leave it to other individuals, they have an inheritance tax of 15% on any amount left to them over $25,000. So for most of us, if you're leaving it to immediate family, the 1% is not big. But if you're looking at leaving some farm assets or real estate or ground to a niece, a nephew, a cousin, because they're back in the operation, that 11% can get up there very quickly. So it's a tax we need to be aware of. But for most of us, what are we going to be concerned about? We're going to be concerned about that federal tax that is at 40%. So when we talk about the federal gift tax exemption and we talk about the federal estate tax or the federal generation skipping tax, each one of us have an exemption amount. And that exemption amount today is $12.9 million, just over $12.9 million. So if we make the math easy, a husband and wife can pass $26 million worth of assets, almost $13 million each, down to the next generation without paying that tax at 40%. Now, they can use that exemption during their lifetime by giving assets away, or they can leave the assets at their death, or they can transfer those assets down to the next generation, i.e. their grandchildren, and pay no tax as long as it's below the exemption amount. Once you use that exemption, or if you have assets that exceed that exemption amount, that's when those assets are subject to the 40% tax. There is aspects where you can give money away during your lifetime without affecting that exemption. That's called your annual exclusion amount. This year, it's $17,000 per person. So mom and dad could essentially give any child $34,000 in cash or assets without using up that $12.9 million exemption. But here's the elephant in the room. This $12.9 million, it will continue to grow for inflation. So just as you see, in 2016, it was 5.5. 2018, Trump doubled it to 11.1, and it's been growing based on inflation ever since. But what's written in tax law today is that that will sunset on January 1st, 2026. It is written into law, and it will fall back to $5 million per person on that date. The only way that this will change is if the Congress and the Senate and the President all sign a new law, either extending the current federal estate tax exemption or doing something different.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
Certainly one size doesn't fit all in agriculture in terms of, you know, their risk management needs.
Former chief economist with the American Farm Bureau Federation, now with the Senate Ag Committee, Dr. John Newton.
Consistently, everywhere we've been, producers have said and talked about the impact of high input costs and the need to address the Title I safety net. Senator Bozeman was in Delaware yesterday visiting with a poultry farmer. She has chicken houses, raising corn and beans. And from the perspective I got from staff that were there, is the stress is real. They're leveraged up to their eyeballs. Costs are going up. Insurance costs are going up. Interest rates are going up. We've got to do something to help these producers in the event that things get worse, as Joe mentioned. And now's the time to do it. You know, we want to make sure this farm bill addresses the safety net and risk management tools that producers need so that over the next 5 years, they've got a viable risk management program they can depend on. And if you look back, I mean, the 18 farm bill didn't help us during the pandemic. It didn't help us, as Stephen mentioned, when tariffs were put on some of our agricultural products. Matter of fact, PLC support price for soybeans never triggered when their biggest buyer left the market. So in the face of some of these black swan events, when your safety net program doesn't work, Congress had to step in and deliver records amount of ad hoc support. That tells any economist that we've got to make these safety net tools work better. We've got to make sure that crop insurance is affordable. And that's Senator Bozeman's priorities, looking at all the tools in the toolbox. As Joe mentioned, make sure that they're bankable so that when these producers go to the bank, they can get a loan. And that brings jobs to rural America. It protects rural America. And when you go across rural America, as Senator Bozeman's done, agriculture is about all there is. And this is an opportunity to protect that rural economy and make a very, very historic and significant investment in this farm bill.
Newton speaking at a recent Farm Foundation forum on the farm bill. Co-director of the Ag Food Policy Center, Joe Outlaw.
Washington is in my career, this is one of the bigger messes that we've been in, I think, because of you have a situation where the compromise is going to be very difficult to achieve. If there is compromise, you might lose the Speaker of the House. If there is compromise, there are going to be people who are going to be unhappy. And so that is a difficult, difficult time to be doing a farm bill. And you know, like it or not, people will usually come together and go, you know what, I kind of support this, but I can see your point of view. But right now in Washington, that's happening less and less over time. And so it makes it very difficult. The debt ceiling deal passed earlier this year put everything behind the eight ball in terms of getting the farm bill done. When I saw the outcome of the debt ceiling, I said I didn't think we'll get a farm bill for a couple of years. I still stand by that. It has nothing to do with the hard work that the people on this Zoom or have. They're putting in the time. It has everything to do with politics. The appropriations process right now and the funding of the government, obviously that's not helping anything in terms of getting a farm bill done, getting any floor time or anything like that. The environment in the House, pretty tough situation. It's not to say that the people who are worried about farm bills are not still focusing on it, but it just says it's going to be tough. So I want to close with the fact that, yes, it would have been nice for the four corners. So I've been here, the majority in the House is actually going to be the lead on this farm bill when it does go to conference. And they will have a big, strong voice when that happens.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
You know, the Inflation Reduction Act, that's $40 billion, right, across forestry, rural development, and the climate smart priorities on the conservation title. But the challenge here, and I think everybody knows it, farm bills are meant to be bipartisan. They're historically bipartisan. I mean, anybody that's been to the committee room knows they sit elbow to elbow. They work on farm policy. They get things done for urban and rural America.
Dr. John Newton is the chief economist with the Senate Ag Committee.
The Inflation Reduction Act was not bipartisan. We didn't have a single hearing about how to spend $40 billion. Republicans didn't have any input on how to spend $40 billion. Farmers didn't have any input on how to spend $40 billion. So you talk about fertilizer management and the priorities there. That's not climate smart. So you can't use your $40 billion to do that. And I think Senator Bolson's priority is if we're going to move those resources, it will be in a bipartisan fashion as part of a bipartisan farm bill that we can reach agreement on.